Fate Potential Podcast.
Welcome to the 11th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast series. I'm Deepak Jayaraman, the creator and curator of this series of conversations, where I talk to people from different walks of life on topics around leadership, transitions, and careers. My objective from this podcast is to have learning conversations with a range of people and share those curated insights with you. I'm really excited to introduce the 11th guest of this podcast, Nanda Nilekani. The paradox here is that the man needs no introduction. From being a member of the founding team at Infosys, to playing a key role in growing it to $3 billion over a period of time, going back to ground zero and starting the UID project and scaling it up with the government, moving on to becoming a key catalyst in the fintech ecosystem in Bangalore, and much, much more. I can't think of too many people that have reinvented themselves several times over like he has. In our conversation, we spoke about his early years in school and college, lessons from starting up and scaling up at Infosys and UID, two very different environments, lessons he learned from contesting the elections in Bangalore, how he thinks about his current portfolio work, and more. We also spoke about why he does what he does and how he's approached the various transitions in his life. Without further ado, over to the conversation. Nandan, thank you so much for your time. It's a privilege and an honor to be talking to you in person. Maybe a good place, Nandan, is to start is just having a sense of what your pie chart of time looks like today. What all do you do today? And more importantly, why do you do what you do?
Sure. Yeah. So maybe to answer that question, I'll just set some background. I've really been for a significant part of my career focused on one large objective. Right. So I spent close to 30 years in Infosys. And at that time, I did Infosys with single-minded passion. I didn't do anything else. I didn't invest in other companies. I really was completely wedded to the Infosys dream.
Yeah.
And then when I worked for about almost 5 years in the government, I was completely focused on making the Aadhaar project successful.
Right.
Then also I didn't do any investments and so on. It's only now when I have tried to follow more of a portfolio approach to my activities.
Mm-hmm.
And so let me just give you how I break it up.
Sure.
I still spend the bulk of my time on what I would call as public service activities. You know, mm-hmm. That is, there's no business involvement in that. That is, I spend about 40% of my time on essentially promoting the Aadhaar and India Stack ecosystem.
Sure.
Because I believe that the future is how businesses, governments, innovators use the unique technology we have in India to transform the way they do business, to reach more customers, to reduce costs, to deliver government services better or what. There are lots of transformational possibilities.
Sure.
And what I've realized is that evangelization of that is hugely required, because you can build something, but unless everybody understands the power of what you have done, it doesn't get used. So 40% of my time goes in activities related to that.
Sure.
Cashless, you know, for example, when this whole demonetization happened, I played a role in how the digital cashless economy could work and so on. So that's 40%.
Sure.
Then the other big thing which happened was after I came back to Bangalore, I was looking for something to do which was impactful. And my wife helped me to find a challenge, which is the challenge of literacy and numeracy for children.
Mm-hmm.
In India, as you know, is a country where there's been huge progress in getting children to go to school. Enrollments in schools have gone up, but teaching outcomes haven't improved the last 15 years since the Sarva Shiksha Abhiyan was launched.
Mm-hmm.
And she and I were in Boston, in Cambridge, one day visiting edX, which is a MOOC set up by Harvard and MIT. And, you know, the people who run edX are friends of mine, Anant Agarwal and Sanjay Sharma.
Mm-hmm.
And they talked about how online education is going to transform higher education.
Sure.
So then she said that...
And this is different from HBX, is it?
HBX is the Harvard Business School's MOOC.
Got it.
They may be using some of the technology from edX, I don't know.
Got it.
But this is a joint venture for a general classical MOOC for all universities.
Okay.
So then she said, why can't we do the same for kids? You know, if you're going to do this for, you know, learning differential equations or business strategy, why can't we do it for people to learn how to read and write, which is India's problem. And I asked her, what's the size of the problem? And she said, 200 million kids. So I said, that sounds like a good problem to solve, because, you know, after the other experience, I was looking for large problems to solve. So that's how we set up this organization called Eggstep, which is co-founded by Rohini, Shankar Marwada, and myself. And we're seeing, how can we use the latest technology to deliver personalized learning and education to millions of kids on a phone? So we use smartphones, tablets, PCs, TVs. It doesn't matter what the device is. It's an infrastructure. We're working with partners. Partners create different kinds of content. And other partners deploy it in the field. And the deployment could happen by governments, by NGOs, by private players. It doesn't matter to us. So the idea is to reach millions of kids in a very short time. So that's 20% of my time. And the, finally, the then I do spend 20% of my time on my various philanthropic initiatives. I'm involved with, I co-founded a proposed university for urbanization called Indian Institute of Human Settlements, which is looking at, because we think urbanization is one of India's huge challenges, and we just don't have the intellectual capacity of people. And also, urbanization is a very multidisciplinary problem. You have to understand many things. So the idea is to create a multidisciplinary urban program. So that's one of the big things I do. And the other big thing is I work with a foundation called E-Governments Foundation, which Srikant Nadamuni and I started some more than 10 years back, which is building a software platform for cities. And our goal is to reach 2,000 cities by 2020. And because we think these are, again, scale benefits. If every city is technology on a much more sophisticated platform, then things will improve. So that's 20%. And the final 20% is the only 20% where I actually engage on business. Because I do believe that I should have some foot in the business world, mainly because the kind of skills that you need to be successful in business require different muscles to be used. And I want to make sure that they didn't atrophy. So I work with about 10 or 15 startups where I'm an investor and help them to scale up. So broadly, 40% on evangelization of the India stack, Aadhaar, UPI, and so on. 20% on Eggstep, literacy and numeracy platform. 20% on philanthropy like IIHS and E-Government Foundation.
Namanti would be in this bucket of 20%?
Yeah, it's more a philanthropic effort. And 20% is startups, which is actually working with young companies to see how they grow. So that's my time allocation.
And if I may double click on that and understand the design principle behind how you came up with this pie chart, any criteria? One is clearly scale and impact you spoke about.
So scale and impact is very important to me because whether it was Infosys or Aadhaar, it was all about scale and impact. At the same time, I didn't, I thought the time had come for me to have a broader palette of things to do, rather than doing one thing. Which meant I didn't want to go back and take a role in government. I didn't want to go back and run a company. And nor did I want to be on the boards of companies, because, you know, I didn't think that was the way I could add value. So scale and impact and creating a palette of opportunities, creating this multi sort of, you know, multi-program approach. It was a conscious choice.
Now, if I may rewind the clock, Nandan, early formative years, one of the pieces I'm curious about is, you know, what are the things that happen in early years which get baked, which drive people and which plays a role as they grow? So if you had to reflect, are there three, four things that got baked into Nandan by the time Nandan turned 15 or 18, which still form a core part of who he is?
Well, I think there are three or four things which I would, which I think will stand out. One is, of course, that I've grown up to be a fairly independent person. And I think the reason for that is that when I was 12 years old, my father had a job in Bangalore. He was a mill manager, and then he had to leave the job. And, you know, his career, he had to move to multiple small towns for short periods of time. And they, my parents were concerned about my educational, you know, sort of continuity.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to stay with my uncle in a small town called Dharwad,
mm.
which is where I did my schooling and my undergrad PUC before I went to IIT. So mm-hmm. I spent about 6 years there. So from the age of 12 to 18.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that at an early age, being independent of my parents and essentially having to manage, I think gave me a strong streak of both independence as well as the ability to manage
sure.
new situations. Since mm-hmm. I went from school in Bangalore to school in Dharwad, big city to small town,
sure.
parents to uncle and so on. So that was one thing which I think helped or rather shaped my thing. The second thing is that my family has been very public spirited. And so my father was very active, even in his old age, doing lots of social work. My uncle was a member of a party called Radical Humanists, which was set up by M.N. Roy. And so he was very idealistic.
Mm-hmm.
So we grew up in a family where the conversations were always larger than about ourselves, about social change and all this. So I think that mm-hmm. that was the second
mm-hmm.
thing which has influenced me, which is also why I chose to spend the bulk of my time on public service.
Mm-hmm.
The third thing I think was dealing with the transition of going from a small town to an IIT.
Mm-hmm.
Because in those days, it's not true today, but it's 80s, 70s, most of the kids who went to IIT were from urban India.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had gone to the top schools in Delhi or Bombay or whatever, and they would go to some Agarwal class and join
sure.
IIT. And I didn't know any of that. So for me, it was a culture shock going from a small town to IIT Bombay. So again, understanding how that worked and getting acclimatized was another sure. big learning experience. And finally, I think the experience I got at IIT was on how to navigate in some sense, because mm-hmm. I was active in social activities. I was the general secretary. I was active in cultural activities. So, you know, I learned how to, you know, work with diverse people and get things done.
Hmm.
So I think all these have been shaping influences.
Got it. And moving forward, you joined Putney Computers in 79. And in a couple of years, you and six others set up Infosys. So give us a sense of the genesis of starting Infosys. How did that come about?
Well, first of all, I think let me explain how I ended up going to Putney. When I came out of IIT, I didn't really have a plan.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my generation was busy doing GRE and GMAT and going sure. abroad and all that stuff. And somehow I didn't feel like doing that. And I missed my IIM exam because I was not well. So generally, I was at a loose end. And that's when I walked into this office of Putney and met Mr. Murthy, who offered me this job. And that's how I ended up joining Putney. And there it was a wonderful experience because that was the first era of mini computers.
Mm.
If you go back in history, you know, in India was dominated by IBM in the 60s, even in the mid 70s. And they would sell these 1401 computers in India. But then they had a different opinion with the government of the day, George Fernandes and so on. So they left India in 77.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, the US was developing this mini computer business.
Mm-hmm.
And Data General was one of the leaders.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned a lot about this. So what I think it enabled me to see the first of many technology shifts.
Mm.
You know, 78, 79 was the shift from mainframes to mini computers.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were other shifts.
Sure.
PCs, LANs, the internet. So I think each of those shifts has been an interesting opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So that opportunity got created and I learned a lot and very happy working with Murthy and other colleagues. So then under the leadership of Murthy, we felt, you know, this is really a people business.
Mm.
And it's about skills, about technology, it's about capability, it's not about capital. Therefore, this industry deserved a company which was very professional, owned and run by the professionals. And that's how we all left and started Infosys in 81.
And just on the point about co-founders, Nandan, given that now you work with multiple startups, are there any lessons from that journey on how entrepreneurs should think about figuring out who they should work with as co-founders?
No, I think the choice of co-founders is one of the seminal choices of any startup for multiple reasons. First is that you must share common vision.
Hmm.
you must share a common value system. You must share a common desire to postpone your gratification for another day. Because building companies, especially building companies to last, is not a sprint, it's a marathon.
Right.
So if your partners are short-term oriented, your partners want quick rewards, if your partners have ethical issues, it doesn't work.
The time frames need to...
Everybody should say, okay, we're willing to defer reward for a decade. That's a big ask. So I think the big lesson in Infosys was that, and Murthy had done a great job in assembling the people, the fact that all of us were united in a common vision to create a global company. All of us were united that you're going to do a very ethically run company with clear standards of ethics and corporate governance. And that we are willing to defer gratification for decades if required. That was the binding glue. And the fact that we put the vision above any of us. So I think getting the right founders is very important from a vision, values, time frame of gratification point of view. But there's a second dimension, which is that common founders are required for complementary skills. Because everybody is not good at everything.
Yeah.
So somebody is good at technology, somebody is good at finance, somebody is good at marketing, somebody is good at strategy, whatever. And therefore, it's one is to make sure they have the same values and so on. But second, they also should have complementary skills. And the best companies have founders who have complementary skills. In our case, we all together, we are cover all the bases in some sense. So I think both these things are very important.
Very interesting. And maybe persisting with the theme, one is about the selection of co-founders who you work with. But also reflecting on the journey, what have been your lessons in terms of what it takes to make it work through the multi-year?
Well, obviously there's the business side of it, right? Having a good strategy, having a good business model, being able to respond to the market. So there's a whole business side.
Sure.
But equally important is the value systems and delayed gratification side of it. You know, in Infosys, we lived on very small salaries for a long time. And we started in 1981, went public only in 1993. So, you know, a huge, more than a decade. So I think making sure that everybody is there. And whenever there's a conflict, and there will be conflicts, but there are so many people and it's over 10 years, making sure that the conflict resolution was the solution that was in the best interest of the company. Because then that became the... tiebreaker in some sense.
Got it.
And I think the third thing is that the passion to build a long-term thing. So, you know, it's because building a company is going through ups and downs, going through highs and lows, going through successes and adversity. So being able to ride that, all those waves and still keeping together is very important.
And double click on the Infosys journey, Nandan. In about 20 years, you built Infosys, you went public, and then you became the CEO. By the time, I think the company was around clocking $600 million from a turnover perspective. And in the next few years, you grew it 5x to make it $3 billion. Just as you reflect on the journey, in your head, what were the key inflection points from a leadership standpoint, if you reflect on your personal journey as the company grew?
Yeah. No, I think this is another very important message, especially for founders who want to remain at the helm of the company for a long time.
Right.
And we see that often today, even in India, where startups, the CEO, often the founders lose their role to professional CEOs. And even in the US, it's quite common. And I think it's the, apart from having that vision and all that stuff, it's the ability to understand that you need to reinvent yourself at every point. That's very important. So, for example, up to the time we went public in 1993, we were a private company and we all did everything. And that model was fine when the company was still just a few million dollars. But as we looked at going public, initially in India in 1993, we realized that this model was not going to work. And secondly, we realized that as global competition became more intensive, we couldn't just be a small unknown company. We had to be visible.
Sure.
So it required a change in strategy. And that also meant that we had to bring in talented people from the outside. And so I think, and that meant that we had to change our role. It was less about doing everything ourselves. It was more about creating a structure, the strategy, getting the right leadership team, empowering them properly, and so on. So I think the first transition happened in 93 when we went from being a private company to a public company.
Mm-hmm.
And also when we took off on our growth curve.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one transition, going right. from a bunch of founders going doing all the things to creating a professional management and creating enough space
right.
to attract high quality talent and give them the empowerment to perform. That's very important because
right.
if founders bring in people and they don't empower right. them, then it doesn't work. I think the second transition was in 99
mm-hmm.
when we became the first Indian company to list on NASDAQ.
Right.
And that brought us to a whole new level of visibility, but also accountability and, you know, the level of detail that US analysts look at your company and all the, it was a whole new experience for us.
Mm-hmm.
So we realized that we had to raise the game even further,
mm-hmm.
Which means very high standards of corporate governance, very good predictability of business, being able to explain business good and bad to analysts, all new skills have to be learned.
Sure.
That was to me the second big transition.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think the third transition was around, was when after the crash
mm-hmm.
in 2001, when we realized that we had to really make our products and services even more value added to attract customers. And then I think when we crossed the $1 billion mark, and because after a billion, we said, how do we go to 10 billion, which sure. Infosys reached recently. So I think these are all the major transition points.
Got it. And back to the one of the things you mentioned in the first transition, when you get key talent from the outside, what's been your experience in terms of what it takes to give them, empowering them and helping them succeed?
Well, I think it's to realize that they are not going to do everything the way you do it. So there's no point in saying, why are you not doing the way I did it? But making sure that as long as they have the right intentions, they have the right talent and they have the right skills, then let them, giving them the space to operate.
Mm.
Being very clear in your strategy, your articulation, your future direction, your rules, your budgets, everything. Reduce ambiguity. Reduce mm. unpredictability.
Mm.
You know, because professional managers often get rattled by volatility of decision making. So, you know, putting a structure in place that gives them continuity of purpose and empowering them, financially empowering them, decision making empowering them, also visibility, making sure that they also become recognized in their field. All these are important things.
Got it. And in terms of your transition, Nandan, when you took on the Infosys CEO role from Mr. Narayanamurthy, two things there, right? One is taking on leadership when someone else has been a leader. So that sort of style transition. And second is, that's probably a time where you were leading some of your other co-founders and maybe some of them were technically reporting in to you.
All of them were, yeah.
So how do you deal, what are the lessons to be learned on managing the transition?
Yeah, so I think it's very important again because it's a very good issue question that how do you, but fortunately in Infosys we had the discipline that whoever was elected the leader, the others would follow him.
Hmm.
So that was one good thing. And the second is that, again, give enough space, give them enough room to do their jobs, give them enough credit, you know, visibility and so on. And also, I think I also very consciously said, I'll spend my time on building the global aspect of our business.
Hmm.
So I consciously carved out for myself because I was playing, which is how to become a global brand, how to become internationally recognized, how to do rainmaking with global customers. You know, that is all what I did. So that also, that was required to take it from 600 million to 3 billion. But it had another benefit that a lot of the roles inside the company were still had to be done.
Got it. Makes sense. So it's also about carving out a piece which is different and distinct and fit for purpose,
yeah.
given the company's
yeah.
evolution.
Yeah.
Got it. And just from the Infosys journey, again, a startup, the company is often going through a turbocharged growth. How do leaders scale up the leadership muscle to stay relevant?
Yeah, so I think that's a very good point. I think the leadership style at 1 million is different from a leadership type at 100 million.
Right.
It's different from 1 billion, different from 10 billion.
Correct.
And I think being able to recognize that each of them are different scale, it requires different leadership. It's not doing it, but getting it done from others.
Hmm.
It's about visioning better. It's about empowering better. These are all very important skills. I mean, if you look at Amazon journey. It's 20 years now from going public.
Right.
It's grown from nothing to this massive corporation because Jeff Bezos was able to reinvent himself as the scale goes up.
And how did you grow as a person? What's the, if you had to decode how you grew?
No,
is there any
lessons
to be learned?
I mean, I didn't have a coach like you. So we had to learn it by ourselves. Everything was on our own. None of us had an MBA degree. None of us had worked in a large company before. None of us had, you know, classical management experience kind of thing. So it was all about, but I think once you have a goal, then, and if you do it very logically, you can actually say, okay, this with this goal, this is what I need to do.
Understood. Moving on, Nandan, you moved on from Infosys and took on the UID challenge. How did this come about?
Well, you know, I had spent 30 years at Infosys. I'd done a lot of stuff. I'd been the CEO. I was the co-chairman. And then, you know, some of our other colleagues became the CEO. So at that time, there was this offer from the government to come and work in the government. And this is again goes back to what I said earlier, that I grew up in an environment of public service. So it was something which was in my blood in some sense. And I had seen the model in the United States, because in the US it's a very common tradition for successful business executives at some point to do public service.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Thomas Watson Jr. Was the US ambassador to Russia after being chairman of IBM.
Interesting. Okay.
And of course, Goldman Sachs has a long tradition from, you know, Rubin to Hank Paulson, going from Goldman Sachs to becoming Secretary of the Treasury. And even today, the current Secretary of Treasury is a former Goldman Sachs guy.
Mm-hmm.
So the US has that tradition. I mean, Robert McNamara went from Ford to the, you know, Johnson administration. So, you know, there's this tradition. So I thought that in that tradition, I could also contribute.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a very good offer from the government of the day. So Prime Minister Manmohan Singh invited me to join the government to the cabinet rank position. And it was an important project. And so we had a informal rule in Infosys that you can't leave without everybody agreeing.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are all in it together. So they all of them are very nice to me and said that, yeah, if there's a opportunity for you to serve in public life, then, you know, it's good. You're contributing to the country. So, you know, it's okay if you leave Infosys. So I got that permission also. That's how, and it was a new challenge for me because I was moving from the private sector to government. Though I'd worked on the fringe of government, I'd never worked in government.
Sure.
I was going from Bangalore to Delhi. And in some sense, I was going from a corner office overlooking a golf course and 100,000 employees plus to a startup.
True.
Because I was employee number one in this new startup. So it was a triple transition for me.
Right.
From government to private sector, from Bangalore's culture to Delhi's culture, and from running a large company to doing a startup all over again. So it was a triple challenge, but you know, I thought it was sufficiently large enough to excite me. So whatever reservations I had, I overcome them and plunged into it.
And reflecting on that transition, and then once again, in terms of what CEOs could learn when they transition from very different cultures from one to another, if you reflected on the first 100 days or 6 months, in hindsight, what were the lessons to be learned?
No, I think first of all, I think there are some lessons that you have learned that are you can continue to use. But there are some lessons you also need to unlearn.
Hmm.
So I think the thing is that it's one thing to transition from running one company to another company.
Right.
I can be CEO of company X and go to company Y.
Sure.
And even though they may be in two different industries, the strategic, the business thinking is
right.
similar because
right.
in both companies, it's all about increasing revenue, profit, market share, all that stuff. But when you go from business to government,
right.
where the parameters of success are very different,
true,
you have to readjust your scale.
Hmm.
And so what I took from Infosys was the bias for action,
mm-hmm.
the focus on timelines, accountability, being transparent about decision making and so on. But what I had to develop, though I had that thing in Infosys, was how to do consensus building, how to get a bunch of people who are have different ideologies or different priorities, how to get them all to align on one goal.
Right.
So that skill, while I had it at Infosys, that skill had to be developed 10x when I went to government.
Hmm.
So I would say that some of my learnings were valid, but some new learnings had to be done. And the other very important thing, which is that you have to be all in.
Hmm.
You know. So I left Infosys and I got off the board and became an ordinary shareholder because I wanted to be fully doing this job.
Very interesting.
And not only that, I gave up all my other private sector roles, including I was on the board of the World Economic Forum, and I was probably one of the first Indian to be on the board of World Economic Forum in Geneva, which runs the Davos thing. That is a very, very prestigious thing for me to be there. But I said, if I'm going to be in the government, then if I'm on some international body, I want to make sure that everything is fine. I was on some international boards. I quit them. So I gave up a lot of things because I wanted to be all in on this.
And was that about creating the mind space in your head, or was it about signaling commitment to the others?
It was both. Mind space so that I could focus on what I was doing with no distraction.
Hmm.
Second, conveying that I'm fully in. I'm not a bird of passage.
You're not hedging bets.
I'm not hedging bets. I'm not having one foot in America, my green card, none of that stuff. I'm very fully in. I've given up everything and I'm doing this for a living. And thirdly, also to make sure there were no ethical conflicts, because I didn't want someone saying, oh, you work on that board, now you're a cabinet rank, any of that stuff.
Got it. Very interesting. And how do you even set a goalpost for when you have a startup with such an ambition? How did you think about what good would look like?
Well, it was just a shot in the dark, because I was very clear that we were going to make a public commitment. Though a lot of people said you're crazy to make a public commitment in the government system because you don't have control over so many variables.
Mm.
But I felt making a public commitment and sharpening everybody's mind towards that was more important than the potential loss of face if I didn't meet it. So the trade-off on balance was to make a public commitment. And my initial thoughts were that, and I said I will make a commitment of how many people will be on Aadhaar platform by the time I step down. And my initial thought was about 400 million.
Mm.
But then, 400 million is a lot of people, but it didn't look good enough. So at some last minute, I changed that to 600 million. So when I went to the government, we made a public statement that we will enroll 600 million people in 5 years. Actually, we did in 4.5 years. We did it faster.
Ah.
So having a public commitment was a learning from Infosys.
Mm.
In Infosys, always you set ambitious goals. You said when we are a $100 million company, we said we'll be a $1 billion company in X years, which we reached. When you're a $1 billion company, we said we'll be a $10 billion company. So what I learned from Infosys was that if you want to stretch an organization, wherever you are, you need to set an ambitious goal from there. So I was using that philosophy in government, though it's much more high risk.
Sure.
Because the number of actors who can stop you is many more.
Right.
But that helped because everybody on the team knew what the goal was.
Mm.
And therefore, it sharpened everybody's sense of urgency and also helped to dissolve internal conflicts.
Got it. And running a startup in a government setup, right? It's probably... it's fascinating to just notice the two extremes in terms of culture. So what can large organizations learn in setting up an entrepreneurial culture in a part of the organization, if you had to reflect on that experience?
No, I think a lot of this I've addressed in my book, Rebooting India, which I've co-authored with Dr. Viral Shah, where I talked about startups in government and explained. So clearly... the challenges of a startup in government are similar to, or probably a little more complex than the challenge of a startup inside a corporate structure. But it has some of the same issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because when there's a certain way of doing things, whether it's in a large company or the government, and you have a startup which has a new way of doing things or is a potential disruption, or in the case of business, it cannibalizes existing revenues.
Mm-hmm. then there's a lot of reaction from the system. So in the corporate, the reaction is because it threatens existing incumbent revenue streams and business leaders. And in the government, it's also threatening if you want to disrupt or disintermediate somebody. So same issues. So you need to have first of all, you need good sponsorship, whether it's in a company or government. Fortunately, I had good sponsorship from the leaders of the government to make this happen. Because when you're a fledgling thing, dealing with established, incumbent, strong, you know,
institutions.
The balance of power is with them. So somebody has to give you air cover with them. Similarly, in the corporate situation, if you have a startup trying something new, the CEO's responsibility to make sure that that startup is protected from all the guys who earn the money and say, why are we wasting money on this stuff? So that's one thing. And there are lots of other lessons. How do you create allies? Mm-hmm. How do you create coalitions who favor what you're doing? So there's a lot of strategy in how do you create a positive coalition who wants what you're doing? Because the fact that there'll be a negative coalition is understood.
Right.
That's a given. So then how do you create a positive coalition?
Got it. And you had a diverse set of people in the team running the Aadhaar project. You had government officials, consultants, volunteers, people in sabbaticals, interns. How do you create a culture in a company with such diversity of thought and backgrounds?
See, the challenge I had when the government situation was twofold. One is that, see, in a business, if I have to make something successful, I need two things. I need the right talent and I need the money to make it successful. In government, both these things are fundamentally not under your control, right? Because the government model is that you can't choose who your team is. You have to use the guys who are given to you.
Allotted
to you. So there's no choice, choice in the human capital. And if you're going to spend money, you have to do it in a particular way. It meets all these A, B, C, D, E, F, all this stuff. So when you neither have control over your money nor over your people, then it's difficult to get anything done. So the way we sorted it out was by saying that we'll create two things. One is, I was fortunate that, see, when I joined the government, one other thing is, one aside I'll tell you is, when you make such a transition, you can use your existing track record to get a seat at the new table. But then you have to earn it all over again. It's important to realize. So the fact that I had been CEO and co-chairman of Infosys and I'd built a big company gave me the credibility to get a seat at a table at the level of a cabinet minister and all that. But that's all it did. It only got me
the door for you.
It only gave me the entry ticket. But having entered that, I had to prove myself all over again.
And what does it take to build that credibility in that system?
So you have to go and you have to assume that you're back to, it's day one again. It's like back to day one, right? A lot of people don't understand that. So when they make the transition, they get the new role on the strength of the old achievements, but don't realize that now they have to.
That doesn't carry forward.
No, you have to prove yourself all over again. So that's one.
Sure.
The other thing is that fortunate, and also the second lesson is that whatever halo effect that you have from your transition lasts only for 6 months. There's a certain halo effect for 6 months because you're new and different, and people will give you a meeting and all that stuff. So whatever you want to get it done during the halo effect. That's another lesson, right?
Interesting.
So one of the things I was very lucky was that I was able to, in the initial days, select my team from the government. Later on, that thing was taken away from me. But first 6 months, my initial core founding team from the government were all people that I was able to actually say, I want this guy, I want this lady, whatever. So the core team we had, Ram Sevak Sharma, Ganga, Srikar, Ashok Pal Singh, Rajesh Bansal, all from the government, were actually handpicked.
And what did you look for when you were staffing up the team?
Actually, it's interesting because it was a self-selection because what I was doing was high risk. So most people in the government system are actually risk averse.
Right.
So the guys who came to me were in some sense the mavericks.
Interesting.
Who are willing to take risks. So I think in that sense, there was some element of self-selection happening. And of course, looking for people who were willing to take risks, who were innovative, who who are outcome oriented,
right?
Who are, you know, willing to work hard, and you know, who are passionate about what they were doing. So that was my thread. Then I realized that this project could not be done only with government people, because there's lots of very, very sophisticated technology which I needed global talent for that. So we came up with a way to hire people from outside, and the government had this thing called NISG, which allows you to recruit people from outside. Then we had a sabbatical where we got people from corporates to come and volunteers, work with us for 2 years. Then we had volunteers who were people who had been there, done that, had been successful serial entrepreneurs, had made a lot of money, but wanted to give back. And then we had interns to give fresh people. So we created structures, all completely legit, sure, approved through due process of government. But using these techniques, we are able to infuse this group with a lot of talent that is not normally working on a government project. And and then I had to blend the two worlds,
right?
The bureaucratic world and the private sector type, right, and blend them together. And that's where having a common mission, which is very extremely ambitious, force everyone to get to the table and get things done.
Interesting. And fast forwarding that journey, Nandan, how did you think about when to move on from this project? And you went to contest the elections in Bangalore as the next step. So I'm curious about how you thought about that transition.
Well, what happened was, first of all, I had always said that I would do this thing for 5 years. And that it was not like a lifetime thing. So that I'd promised that I would deliver the platform, build the tech, get it rolled out, get applications built like DBT,
sure,
and we would reach 600 million people. And I reached that stage in March,
sure,
March of 2014. So that's when I stepped down after I'd fulfilled my commitments. Now, what I realized though was when I spent that time in the government was that the potential of technology to transform India was not sufficiently internalized by the system, because people didn't come from that background. People were not technological background. Very few people like me were in the system. So then I realized that I'm a big believer that technological transformation is the way to go, because that's the only way you're going to fix a lot of India's endemic issues. And then I thought, many times I was not able to sell my ideas, saying you can do this, you can do that. So I was getting a bit, you know, frustrated with my inability to sell my ideas. So then I said, maybe I should be one of them. Maybe if I'm a politician, then I'll have a voice. I'll be the decision-making guy. So, and then I have the legitimacy to say this is the way to do it. So that's what drove, it was an intellectual choice actually, to get into politics. But my experience was not very happy. And in that sense, I think that was one transition where I stepped too far in some sense. It was way outside my comfort zone. So I, after the election campaign and after that, I realized that this was not where I want to be, that I didn't have the leverage. I didn't have competitive advantage in that area. I didn't think I would be very effective. So I realized that actually my effectiveness comes from being what I'm good at, which is a technology-led transformation agent, and use my talents and abilities to solve large, intractable problems and make that available to anybody who wants to use it. So that was my shift. And then, of course, I explained to you that I was looking for something to do, and then
the portfolio approach.
I know. And this eighth step happened, the idea of, and then the whole portfolio approach.
Right. And just back to that transition for, let's say, leaders and CEOs who are looking for a career in politics or considering a career in politics, any lessons or any...
So I'll tell you, I mean, it's very simple. A lot of my consensus building skills, which I'd honed in government, were obviously useful there.
Right.
But it is first of all, it's an extremely time-intensive activity. Retail politics. I'm not talking... There's always this so-called Rajya Sabha route where you get nominated and all. But then you become beholden to someone, and they didn't want to get into that situation. So then I said, if I'm going to be in that game, I should win an election, because that's the rites of passage of that business. But then it becomes very retail intensive, because in every constituency there are millions of people.
It's a B2C.
It's a B2C business. It's a B2C kind of thing. And everybody wants real-time attention. You can't say, okay, send me an email or call center or something. So it's very, very time intensive.
Right.
It's also lots of pressure groups, different caste, religion, this, that, all that stuff. And also, I was hampered by the fact that I was not a good public speaker in any Indian language. Hmm. And I don't think you can be in Indian politics unless you're very good at it, being a public speaker in Hindi or Kannada or Marathi or whatever. So, and there was no, so I didn't have leverage. Hmm. So, I quickly realized that I was not going to be effective in this stuff.
Hmm. Hmm. Got it. So, just a couple of questions to wrap up, Nandan. If you really reflect on your journey and really think about what has enabled you to reinvent yourself so often and stay relevant and be of value to the wider society, what are the 3-4 things that you've learned from your journey?
Yeah, I can tell you, and everybody may not agree that this is my, for example, my wife doesn't agree with my strategy. So it's not obvious that it's like great advice, but let me tell you anyway. One thing is I never look back. I never look back. So whenever I embark on a new journey, I say this is my life from now on. Of course, I'll have very pleasant memories of my previous life, but I'm not going to keep harking back. So that's an important thing, never looking back. My wife says that shows that you're incapable of, you know, learning from the past or whatever. I'm saying it depends on how you...
I hear you.
The second thing is that I tend to be an optimist. Mm-hmm. Again, my wife says I'm an irrational optimist or a whatever. So I always look at the bright side of things. So, which is very helpful when you're facing adversity, because you can always figure out some positive thing. But it also can be thought as a form of self-denial, mm-hmm. that you're not recognizing the problem. Mm-hmm. I don't know which one it is. So I think this ability of looking forward and being optimistic provides a lot of the emotional drive for me to do new things. And I think my willingness to reset my life, you know, sometimes you get too much into a comfort zone and then you don't have the ability to say, okay, let me restart.
Mm.
So I think I have, basically because I didn't really start my life with some huge ambition or anything, for me to restart in a completely new direction, it comes very easily, which is actually, I find, not that true with most people. For example, one of the things I'm doing now is I'm working with this guy, my good friend Sanjeev Agarwal of Helion. We are setting up a scale-up coalition. Because what I learned after working with startups for 2 years is that there are lots of startups, there are very few scale-ups. And scale-ups to me is what we did at Infosys, or what Mr. Premji did at Wipro, or what Uday Kotak is doing at Kotak Bank, or what Kiran Mazumdar has done at Biocon, or what Sunil Mittal did at Airtel, is over 10, 20 years build multi-billion dollar large enterprises. And I think there's an art of doing that, scaling up. And, you know, we've been there, done that. I've done it both in government and in the private sector. So actually creating a pool of capital, a $100 million fund, of which we are putting a lot of it ourselves, and saying, let's work with companies that are ready to scale up and where they have a vision of building companies to last. And we'll help. We'll bring in the right thinking, technology, leadership development, maybe coaching from you, whatever. And that's a whole new role I'm doing.
Very interesting.
So I think I have the advantage that I can enter a new role and be willing to gamble, you know, take whatever way the chips fall. So that's probably other thing which I have, which enables me to do this. And then finally, I think for me, return on my time invested is very important. So for me, the biggest opportunity cost is the cost of my time.
Correct.
And therefore, I always make sure that I have, whatever I do, there's a high ROTI, return on time invested.
And what dimensions do you measure the return?
So, impact. It should impact people, it should make a change, it should move the needle on society, those kind of things.
And in summary, Nandan, this podcast is titled Play to Potential, which is about individuals really being the best they can be. In summary, any 1 or 2 thoughts in parting for people to play to their potential?
No, I think most of us are vastly underplaying our potential. I mean, I think finally it's all inside you. It's in your mind. It's in your vision. It's in your value system. It's in your ability to stamina to run the race. It's all inside. Mm. And I think most people I meet are, including myself, are vastly underplaying their potential. So I think it's just, you know, look inside and the sky's the limit.
Mm. Wonderful, Nandan. It's been a real honor talking to you. Sure. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Deepak. And thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank
you.
The phrase sky's the limit reminded me of something that came up in my conversation with my first podcast guest, Vijay Amritraj, the tennis legend. When I asked him the same question, here's what he said.
In one of my interviews, one of my guests on one of my talk shows was the second man on the moon, Buzz Aldrin, who was a friend of mine. And when I went to interview him at his home in Westwood in California, you know, you look at all the various accolades and so on and so forth, like we've seen in people's homes and trophies and plaques and so on and so forth. So very few things really catch your eye as you go through pictures and you go through this and that. But there was this one little plaque in the corner that absolutely caught my eye. And I've never forgotten it. And it always is very much in the back of my mind when I do things. And it was stuck in a corner in his living room. And it said, you know, we always tell kids as you grow up, you know, you better do this. You know, if you fulfill your potential, sky's the limit, sky's the limit. You know, everything, it's always sky's the limit, you know. And so that little plaque said, who said sky's the limit when I left my footprints on the moon?
Fascinating.
As Nandan says, it's often the inner journey which makes a big difference in the long run. I hope you found the conversation as energizing and purposeful as I did. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations of the Play to Potential podcast series. For accessing some of the earlier conversations, please visit playtopotential.com. Bye now.